Hi, I'm Isaac DeVere, and welcome to Off Message. Today's guest, Senator Tom Cotton, freshman senator from Arkansas, and one of the leading young Republican lights in the Senate, very prominent in the party, even though he's only been in the Senate since winning in 2014, very quickly positioned himself as a person who is in front of the cameras a lot and also very active behind the scenes. He was even doing some nosing around about potentially running for president in 2020, had Donald Trump lost, spotted in Iowa. He instead, as he said, came very quickly to the conclusion that he needed to, like everybody else, accept that Donald Trump is president, work with Donald Trump as president, and he has been very successful at doing that. But these are strange times for the Republican Party. They don't know exactly what they stand for. Is it the party of Reagan? Is it the party of Trump? What do they do on immigration reform, foreign policy? All these things that Trump has stirred up, Republicans in Congress don't know what to make of it and how to position themselves. And we see that playing out in even what's going on over the Obamacare fight. And Cotton, who served in the military, is someone who was right in the middle of the Obamacare fight, but also right in the middle of all of the things about Syria and foreign policy, questions that have come up around Trump. We're going to start out, though, with Eliana Johnson talking about where she sees Cotton fitting into this, joining us again, my colleague from Politico, and how the Republican identity crisis that she's seeing in her reporting is connected to what Tom Cotton was talking about. I want to remind everybody to follow me on Facebook and on Twitter at Isaac DeVere. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes. And of course, email me with your feedback. We want to hear what you're thinking, who you'd want to see on, what you think we should be thinking about that we may not be thinking about already. That email address is Isaac, I-S-A-A-C, at Politico.com. So here, start us off, my conversation with Eliana Johnson, national political reporter for Politico. So you just spent some time writing a piece about Tom Cotton. What did that tell you about who he is within Congress at this point and within the future of the Republican Party?
You know, I think Cotton is maybe the most interesting lawmaker on Capitol Hill right now.
Well, that's why we had him on the podcast.
I mean, of course, I know you only book the most interesting guests, but he's in a really interesting position. He's somebody who very early, I mean, even before he ran for Congress, he was known in conservative circles. But his biggest promoters, Bill Kristol, then the editor of the Weekly Standard, and the mega donor, Paul Singer, they were never Trumpers. And then Cotton emerged when Trump had his maiden visit to Capitol Hill with lawmakers. There were a lot of sort of little known congressmen who showed up. Jeff Sessions had already endorsed Trump in the Republican primary at that point.
Yeah, so we're talking last spring.
In March of 2016. And Tom Cotton showed up. And he never planned to endorse in the Republican primary and never did endorse. But it was a big deal that he showed up at that meeting. And Tom Cotton went. And he continued to be more open and more friendly to Trump, not only in the primary, but in the general election. And that really distinguished him from the rest of his Senate colleagues. And he said, not only in the primary, but also in the general election, that Trump was more fit to be a commander-in-chief than Hillary Clinton. And even as other senators rescinded their endorsements, Cotton was a pretty steadfast ally of Trump.
And of course, he's from Arkansas, right? So he's known the Clintons for some time. he must have, growing up in Arkansas, Bill Clinton must have been governor as he was a child, right?
And not only that, but, you know, I think the politics for him were pretty easy to figure out. The Clintons are loathed in Arkansas. He now represents Arkansas. But Bill Kristol, in one of his early pieces about Cotton, actually compared him to Bill Clinton as this precocious political talent from Arkansas, but, you know, with more morals. So it was interesting to see him stand by Trump through all of this. And it's put him in this really interesting position. Trump interviewed him to be defense secretary, and he's developed relationships.
Did he want to be defense secretary?
I think he would have loved to be defense secretary.
So why didn't he get the job?
I think that was not because of a lack of wanting on Senator Cotton's part.
Was it because when Jim Mattis said that he was interested and Trump just wanted to go in that direction?
I think Trump is somebody who likes – you've seen him lean on the military pretty heavily.
And what are we at, five – generals and high-ranking positions in the administration.
Yeah, but what's so interesting to me is that I think you see Senator Cotton's loyalty really paying off in that he has relationships in the White House that transcend family and sort of ideological faction. He has a longstanding relationship with Steve Bannon, but also a longstanding relationship with Ryan Priebus, has gotten to know Jared Kushner. He's somebody who—
He's of about the same age as Kushner and Ivanka Trump.
Like they're, right. They're, right.
He's on the—what is he, 45?
He's 39. Mm-hmm.
All right. There you go.
I know. He's in an interesting position where he's pushed people into the administration by recommending them and kept people out. He was strongly critical of Ann Patterson, the former ambassador to Egypt in the Obama administration, who Secretary of Defense Mattis wanted to run policy mm-hmm. at the Pentagon. And he's been critical of a couple others who then haven't gotten jobs. But he's pushed many people and recommended McMaster for the National Security Advisor job, recommended General Kelly. So he's kept tabs on these military men who are reaching the end of their tours.
Yep.
And so I think,
and they, I'm sure, have picked up on the fact that he is a good way
yes.
in.
Yeah.
He made a trip to Iowa last year before the election at that time that seemed so long ago when there was just no way that Donald Trump was going to win and Republicans were starting to think about 2020. As you say, he's 39 years old. He can certainly wait for a little bit to run and still be a young man if he wants to be president. He does want to be president, though, right?
I think his ambitions are unlimited, and he's tremendously capable. And I think for the Trump administration, he's somebody who has real credibility with conservatives, and it's very useful to the president when Tom Cotton can go out and back him up on things. But it's worth noting that he doesn't always do so. He was very critical of the health care bill, and he's been critical of the administration on other things. So I think he's influential.
All right, Eliana, we had you for back-to-backs here with the John Kasich interview and now this one. And the few people around are better at helping us sort out what's going on in the Republican Party. So thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
And now our conversation with Tom Cotton. Let's start with an easy one. What does the Republican Party stand for right now? And how has that changed in the last year as the presidential primary sort of finished and obviously now with President Trump in and to a lot of people challenging some of the core things that people thought that the party stood for?
I would return to our presidential primaries a little over a year ago and think through some of the things that made Donald Trump distinctive among everybody up on that stage. It wasn't Obamacare. It wasn't tax policy. Those are very important to most Americans. But in one way or another, pretty much everybody up there on that stage was saying Obamacare is failing, as it is, and we're going to fix health care reform as we need to. That's not what made Donald Trump distinctive. What made him distinctive are issues like immigration, crime, mm-hmm. trade, foreign policy, and so forth. And the Republican Party as an institution needs to reflect on why he won those primaries and then why he didn't just beat Hillary Clinton, but beat her in places where Republicans had not won right. for decades, like in Wisconsin or in Pennsylvania. And won back some states that we had not won since George W. Bush, like Ohio, for instance. And I think you have to connect those two. You have to recognize that our party's leadership was selling a product that wasn't that popular, not only with swing voters who make a difference in states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, but among a lot of Republicans too, especially at a time when you'd see growing strains on blue-collar families in states like that. You know, that's how Ronald Reagan won such smashing victories, not by, you know, being the leader of the conservative movement, though he was that, but by being a practical politician who could say, we're going to make your lives better. We're going to increase wages. We're going to make sure that people are getting back to work. We're going to make your streets safer, and we're going to stand up to and ultimately beat the Soviet Union. And that's the same thing that Donald Trump did on some issues that really matter in communities all across the country.
I asked John Kasich this, who I bet has a somewhat different view in his answer to this question than you do, but I'm curious. Is it the party of Reagan. Is it the party of Trump now? Is the Republican Party the party of Trump? You're smiling.
Well, the president of his party is always the leader of his party. There's no way around that. George Bush was the leader of our party when he was president. Barack Obama was the leader of the Democratic Party. Donald Trump is now the leader of the Republican Party. That doesn't mean that I will vote for every bill that Donald Trump sends to the Congress. That doesn't mean I'll support every policy he announces or every statement he makes. But when your party is in power at the White House, the president is the head of your party. Sure. That's why he picks.
But does
that
redefine the party?
That's why he picks the party chairman. That's mm-hmm. why the party chairman in the states end up reflecting him. So I would say that the Republican Party, at a philosophical level, is a reflection of all of the people who make up the party. But as from an institutional standpoint, Donald Trump's the leader of our party. So Ronald Reagan is still a very influential figure in our party, in the same way that Abraham Lincoln is a still very influential figure in our party. In some ways, I think you could say that Donald Trump is resurrecting some of the tenets of the Republican Party of Lincoln and McKinley and Coolidge, mm-hmm. you know, at a time when the Republican Party dominated national politics in a way that almost no party ever has.
Lincoln how?
Lincoln, I mean, so in Lincoln's day, the Republican Party was primarily anti-slavery. It was founded in the 1850s primarily as an anti-slavery party, also as an anti-polygamy party, the twin pillars of barbarism, the party called it as. But Lincoln also spoke about free men, free soil, and free labor. And he put a lot of emphasis on making America the kind of land where anyone could live his life. You know, he gives a famous speech late in the war to a regiment from Ohio for a short speech on the lawn of the White House. And you can imagine the scene. They've seen very tough fighting in Northern Virginia. They've probably lost several of their brothers in arms. I think it's late summer, so it's hot and humid yeah. in August, just the way it is here. And he talks about the inestimable jewel of America, that any one of you sitting on this lawn right here, after all this brutal fighting, probably the children of farmers or shopkeepers or what have you, could grow up one day to live in this big White House, just like my father's son has. I mean, Lincoln truly came from nothing, and he yeah. really was self-made. He didn't go to college. He didn't have a fancy degree. He didn't get an internship, you know, on the equivalent of Wall Street at the time, that he really was a self-made man. And you don't have to live in that big White House to achieve that dream either. You can be an esteemed lawyer the way Lincoln was in Springfield and a leader of your community, an accomplished businessman, a respected pastor, a good school teacher, or what have you. But that's really the promise of America. Focusing on delivering that promise to everyone at a time when more and more Americans think that our country is not delivering on it, I think is something that our party had forgotten about.
Yeah. Does it challenge your thinking now? One of the things that we see going on among a lot of Republicans is readjusting to life, having full control of what's going on in Washington. And I wonder whether it challenges the way that you think about what a conservative does, the function of a conservative in government. Because for when the Democrats were in control of the House and Senate and through the Obama years, it was a lot of stopping what he was doing. And now I wonder, is it still that? Obviously, you don't have Obama there. Is it still stopping things, or is it getting the leadership to change the way that they are, right? Like what you were saying, the leadership was selling something that people didn't want.
Sometimes the Congress has to stop bad ideas from the executive, and that's regardless of who sits in those particular seats. You know, I would say that I, first and foremost, am representing the interest and the views and the principles of the people of Arkansas. And I'll say about Donald Trump exactly what I said about him as a candidate and what I would say about Barack Obama as well. I will support him when I think he's right. I'll try to change his mind when I think he's wrong, and I'll vote against him if I can't. Now, since Donald Trump's a Republican, and as am I think that he's right a lot more often than Barack Obama was.
That'll be the big news out of this, that you think Donald Trump's right more often than Barack Obama.
Well, because he is more willing to listen.
Right.
To members of Congress of both parties, even if you talk to Democrats, I think they'll admit that, than the Obama administration ever was, I have more opportunity to try to change his mind or to try to change the mind of his cabinet secretaries when I think they're going wrong. But failing that, I'll have to vote no when I think they aren't. But then, you know, 4 years ago, I was one of very few Republicans in the Congress who supported airstrikes against Syria in September of 2013 when they first verifiably used chemical gas against their own people. And that was one of the very, very few times, probably the only time for working matters, that I was at the White House in the Obama administration. And the only time senior administration officials were calling me and asking for my help. And I was happy to give it to them because Barack Obama ought to enforce his own red line, and he didn't. And we've seen a lot of consequences.
And you're happy with what President Trump did on that?
Very much so. Not just on its own merits. Bashar al-Assad needed to be punished for using chemical weapons, and he needed to pay a consequence for violating a treaty that he willingly signed in 2013, the Chemical Weapons Convention. But we also had to send the signal to him that we would not tolerate the use of chemical weapons on a battlefield where we now have hundreds of Americans and thousands of our allies, troops, and proxies. But also, it goes far beyond Syria as well. It helps restore much of the lost credibility mm-hmm. of America over the last 4 years.
In one night's worth of bombing that you feel like that
yes,
happened?
Yes. I mean, I cannot tell you the number of foreign ministers, defense ministers, ambassadors, and heads of state that I've met either in this office or overseas who have asked me about that red line controversy, in part because they know that I was one of the very few Republicans yeah. who supported airstrikes at the time. And it's not just in the Middle East. It'd be one thing if an Arab country that wanted Assad removed and was opposed to Iran said, what does this mean for security guarantees for my little country? But it happened all around the world. It happened in East Asia and Europe and South Asia. When the United States is the central figure in every security system in the world, and the United States' credibility is key to that system, which is to say the president's credibility, it has far-reaching consequences. And now the fact that President Trump showed that he was willing to enforce an American red line, one that he didn't even draw to begin with, I think reverberates around the world.
It's been a couple of weeks since that happened. Now, we haven't seen any more chemical weapons being used by Assad, but on the other hand, we haven't seen any follow-up from the Trump administration about what the next step is in Syria. Is that an issue, do you think?
Well, I know they're undertaking a thorough and deliberate review of their Syria policy, as there are with Iran policy and North Korea policy, and I think that's appropriate. And Syria is a very thorny problem, much thornier than it was 4 years ago when those airstrikes should have occurred, or that it would be today if they had occurred. So I've got no issue that they're undertaking that review, and we'll see where it goes. Again, the battlefield has changed there substantially, even since the campaign last year. I think it's appropriate that they take that kind of deliberate, thorough review. But at the same time, there's no reason why they can't take punitive, retaliatory strikes against Syria and prejudice the outcome of that review of one way or other, whether it's something that I would like or something that I wouldn't like.
You mentioned Iran. I assume your conversations with the Obama administration were different about Syria than they were about Iran. You wrote that letter to the Iranian government saying that they should be aware that the deal could get canceled, which talking to people at the Obama White House then, where they didn't love it.
Presidents usually don't like it when the Congress inserts itself in foreign policy, but the Constitution reserves an important role for us in foreign policy. I think in general, a statutory approach to foreign policy making is not ideal, but as we saw in the Obama administration, when the president consistently cuts Congress out of that policymaking process, then Congress is more likely to insert itself through statutes.
But President Trump has been somewhat noncommittal about where he's going to be on the Iran deal. During the campaign, he was pretty clear about it, but that's not where he's. Are you disappointed that he hasn't moved more quickly to scrap the deal? He's said actually some positive things about it.
No, because it's part of the broader Iran policy review. Mm-hmm. So I did talk a lot to Obama administration officials about the nuclear deal with Iran, mostly intelligence officials, some career, mm-hmm. some appointed, because on the Intelligence Committee, we were frequently
sure.
reviewing the implications of the deal and compliance with it and so forth. But that's just one small aspect of our relationship with Iran. And the longest term, gravest consequences of the nuclear deal with Iran is that it has those sunset dates and it's allowed Iran to continue much of its advanced technological work. And it will put them on the path to a weaponized nuclear program in a matter of years. That's the longest term, the gravest consequences. But the more immediate consequence is that it viewed in isolation Iran's nuclear program from every other aspect of Iran's nefarious actions around the world. Its imperial campaign of aggression throughout the Middle East, its support for insurgencies in countries where we have allies like Iraq and Bahrain and Yemen, support for terrorism, ballistic missile tests, and so forth. Both President Trump and Secretary of State Tillerson have been clearly and properly insistent that we're not going to accept that equation anymore. We are no longer going to continue the kind of accommodating, conciliating approach in all domains that President Obama and his administration took. In fact, your publication had a good story a few days.
It happens every once in a while.
A few days ago. Every once in a while, on a blue moon, right? Never written by you. No. Frequently written by you and many of the fine journalists you have. That dug a lot deeper into all of the ways that the Obama administration bent over backwards to prevent, you know, any kind of displeasure in Tehran about, you know, the deal where we traded hostages and, you know, they downplayed
and lots of side deals that were part of that. And
all the side deals. And it's a reminder, even with a outlaw country like Iran, with whom we don't have diplomatic relations, there is no end of touch points where you can bring pressure to bear on them. And the consistent approach of the Obama administration was not to pressure Iran. I think the whatever the result of the Iran policy review is, I think it's safe to say that Tehran is going to be facing the opposite situation now, where they are constantly facing greater pressure from the United States and our Arab allies in Israel and the region.
It seems like the domestic politics, you feel like there's been some shifting about what the Republican Party stands for and how Trump has challenged that. With foreign policy, you feel like it's coming back to the maybe a more traditional Republican approach actually under Trump, right? Or is that wrong?
If you were to review the first 100 days of Donald Trump's administration, much as
I thought you didn't want to do
dislike that phrase, since we elect presidents for 4-year terms
for 1400 days.
Yeah. Well, if you want to talk about a bad 100 days, imagine if Politico had been around to cover Abraham Lincoln's first 100 days.
Yes.
He lost another state.
I would have.
Is Missouri going to go?
We would have had some breaking news alerts.
Yeah. So, but if you look at these first 3 months, I think you would say that Donald Trump's foreign policy has been much more in keeping, not just with Republican foreign policy, but with the bipartisan foreign policy approach that we saw from Reagan through at least Clinton. And I would say through George W. Bush as well. George W. Bush, in many ways, continued Clinton-era policies for the first 8 months of his administration. 9/11 was obviously a huge shock to our country and a major threat. I think most post-World War II leaders would have done the same things that George Bush did in Afghanistan and Iraq, at least at the beginning. I think after 3 months of Donald Trump, it appears increasingly so that Barack Obama is the one who broke with, you know, 70 years of post-war foreign policy consensus. Yeah, there were lots of differences. You know, you had, you know, disputes between the Carterites and the Reaganites and so forth, but there was a fundamental continuity to our post-war policy, I would say, up to Barack Obama. He was the big break.
You are one of the few members of the Senate to have been anywhere near battlefield, except on a CODEL recently. A few members in the House, too. I mean, more and more as we get further away from the invasion of Iraq and more people come out. But a lot of people enlist earlier in their lives than you did. You were already 28 when you went, right?
I signed my contract in December of 2004, so I would have been 27.
Right. So a lot of people go when they're younger, when they're still figuring out more of their sense of the world. How much did being there, being on the ground, challenge where you were on some of these issues and make you rethink any of your thoughts on it?
When you're leading a platoon in Iraq, especially when I was there in 2006, I mean, it gives you a very compelling appreciation of ground truth. I can tell you in 2006, which was the months before the surge, you know, you'd come back from a long patrol and maybe, you know, flip on Armed Forces Network and catch a ball game or catch some news, and you'd see some politician or pundit in favor of the Iraq War, supportive of George W. Bush, talking about what was happening in the country, and did not really reflect what we were seeing on the ground in 2006. You know, anybody who was on the front lines, by which I mean anybody at the battalion level and below who was actually going on regular patrols, could tell you all the problems that we had, all the problems that the surge was intended to address and did in fact address. Those were not, you know, new insights to me or to the privates I had in my platoon. They knew that we didn't have enough troops. They knew that we were spending too much time on big bases. They knew that we were more focused on just kind of, you know, targeting whatever bad guys we could find rather than winning over the support of the local population. They knew, in short, that we needed a counterinsurgency strategy, which we were not pursuing. Mm-hmm. And to pursue that strategy, we needed more troops. And we probably at that point needed, you know, different leadership as well. And those are all the things that the surge delivered. So as I say, there was a big break in the way we were conducting particular policies after 9/11. I think if those attacks had happened in the late Clinton administration, we would have seen very similar actions, though, in Afghanistan and Iraq. If Al Gore had won 2000, very similar actions, I believe. That doesn't mean that George Bush and his team obviously conducted a perfect war. Sure. No president ever does so. Again, to go back to Lincoln, there are lots of fits and starts as he was finding the right team and the right strategy. So especially in the middling years, you know, in 05 and 06, we were struggling mighty. It was only in 07 when, in his finest hour, George Bush had the courage to buck conventional wisdom in Washington and popular opinion and pursue a strategy that would actually win.
Do you feel like your ideology came through it intact? Was there any, did you rethink any bits of it?
I did not develop my worldview because I joined the Army. I joined the Army in part because of my worldview. And that was a worldview shaped by my parents growing up, mm-hmm. you know, on a farm in rural Arkansas, where, you know, you have to be pretty practical and hard-nosed and concrete about things. From my father, who himself had served in Vietnam, from growing up among a very conservative mm-hmm. way of life. And I don't mean that necessarily like in a political sense, like conscious of a conservative.
I was reading something that your father felt like it was like punishment for when you enlisted, right?
he had done something similar to his father. And he said that he felt like God was punishing him for what he did to his dad in 1968. And God wasn't punishing either one of us. God had called both of us to serve our country. But I grew up around Democrats. I didn't really know that because my family wasn't political mm-hmm. and it wasn't a real political area, but it was a very conservative area. It was, you know, in the sense that, you know, why do you join the Army in 1968?
Yeah.
You know, when you get out of college, it's because your country's at war and you go serve your country when it's at war. Likewise, you know, why did I join the Army? It's because my country was attacked and 3,000 of my countrymen were killed. And that's just what you should do. Especially if you're young and you're able-bodied and you don't have a wife and children, then you join and you serve.
Did you think you were going to die there at points?
I'll just say that I drive safely because I think I spent 8 of my 9 lives over there.
Well, I mean, that experience, it's not, I've never been on a battlefield. I think people who haven't, want to really think about what that means to know.
I can reflect on a handful of decisions in Iraq where either my decisions or developments that if they had gone the other way,
like what?
Just deciding to mount up in a truck after conducting a foot patrol for a pretty long while. And then, you know, 300 meters later, hitting a roadside bomb mm-hmm. that was activated by a passive infrared device. So if we hadn't mounted up and we had continued to walk those 300 meters, then it would have been my foot that was activating that passive infrared device, not the front tire of my truck. Or, you know, and not just but my men.
But it was more that sort of the path not taken than feeling like
know, like what's, you know, when you're in the sights of a sniper, for instance. Or, you know, not just me, but my men as well. You know, if you didn't enforce, you know, good standards and, mm-hmm. and insist your gunners, for instance, stay seated behind their armor when the truck was moving. There was a time when, you know, I saw a bomb. I mean, I saw a can. Mm-hmm. It was right after the combat engineers had cleaned off all the median and the ditches, which is where trash piled up and therefore where bombs were hidden. And I say it was great. It's all completely clean. No one could hide a bomb there. Where there was that one can there that could be a bomb. And as I was thinking that, it went off.
Yeah.
And it went off right in my face outside the window of my Humvee. And my gunner, fortunately, was seated as he was supposed to be according to standard operating procedure. If he had been standing, he would have been mm-hmm. decapitated by it. So I was fortunate that I didn't have any man under my command lose his life. I had men in my company and my battalion lose their lives. But no, there's lots of times when I look back and I think, yeah, we were lucky to get out alive. And there were times, too, towards the end of my time in Iraq in 2006, where the casualty rate was increasing significantly, the sophisticated advanced bombs from Iran were beginning to show up again, which could go through an Abrams tank, much less go through our little Humvees. And you know, I told my father, I didn't tell my mother, that if they had not heard from me in more than 24 hours, that I was fine because the battalion standard for casualty notification was 24 hours mm-hmm. from the time someone is wounded and removed from the line or killed. That the next of kin, in that case, my parents, would be notified. So I might be negligent. I might be out on a long-range patrol. But if it had been more than 24 hours since they last heard from me, they could be certain.
Sort of a twist on the
that that I was still alive. And my father's response to an email I sent was, "I understand. Do not tell your mother that."
I want to come back and talk. You mentioned immigration a little while ago. That is one of these issues that the Republican Party is, it seems like, really shifted on, right? In 2006, when you're in Iraq, when George W. Bush was talking about immigration policy, we're not at that place for the Republican Party. What does that mean we are at the place of for the Republican Party? What is, we know what Donald Trump said during the campaign. We've seen the travel ban. We've seen some discussion over the border wall, but not a lot of clear sense of what the immigration policy is going to be.
Immigration policy should be guided by a single overarching goal, which is the well-being of American citizens. I feel for my fellow man all around the world. I serve my fellow citizens. So our immigration policy should serve the interests of our citizens. When you look at it from that lens, I think some of the failures to change our immigration laws over the last 10 or 12 years are pretty clear. And since you bring up the 2006 attempt, I'll share a perspective on it that links my time in Iraq. When I left for Iraq, there was the beginnings of a push for what's known as comprehensive immigration reform in Washington, which is really just a code word for amnesty first immigration reform. So I leave for Iraq. I mean, I would occasionally check Armed Forces Network, you know, read the news online.
And you voted for George Bush.
I did.
Yeah.
And I didn't follow, though, when I was in Iraq, the immigration debates all that closely, as you might imagine. I had more pressing matters on my mind. Then I get back to the United States around Thanksgiving, and all that's happened is they passed the Secure Fence Act. And I always thought that was a pretty telling example of where popular opinion is on immigration, that when I left for Iraq, you had elite bipartisan consensus in Washington to give amnesty to illegal immigrants, to substantially increase levels of legal immigration, particularly unskilled and low-skilled work, with some talk about enforcement, but unlikely to get it based on the 1986 experience. And I got back after a campaign, and all you got was a promise to build a fence on our southern border.
Would you want to see Trump's border wall?
Yes. Now, I'm open-minded to John Kelly coming here and telling us there are certain areas where it's not feasible from a technical standpoint.
But the level of investment that is being talked about is a huge amount of money.
Fences work. You know, it's ironic that you have so many protesters in California about the fence, from the governor and the legislature on down to activists on the street, because California's border is mostly fenced off. And that fence has largely worked. That's why illegal immigration is a much bigger issue in Arizona and Texas. Now, in New Mexico, it's an issue, but it's not as big an issue because the terrain there is just so much more forbidding. So I'm open to John Kelly telling me there are places where we don't need a fence. It's not feasible to construct it because of shifting sand dunes or cliffs or whatever. And the terrain and the climate is so forbidding that it's not worth the money spent. But in general, fences work. That's why we have them on our southern border. That's why there's one around the White House. And when you build a fence, all it does is sit there and work. It doesn't complain about the heat or the cold. It doesn't ask for time off to take its kid to school. It doesn't call in sick. It doesn't get reversed or defunded by a future administration. It doesn't share your priorities. All it does is sit there and work.
Do you worry about that? What that says, the Obama administration, the Democratic feeling about immigration reform, and even where John Boehner was when after 2012, they were thinking about the politics of this, that it's not a winning argument. Obviously, we saw that challenge by the Trump campaign, but there's still this demographic argument, right, that longer term, it's a problem for the Republican Party.
I think enforcing our immigration laws is actually one way to win Hispanic votes, because the impacts of mass immigration, both legal immigration that's unskilled or low skilled and illegal immigration, which usually shares those economic traits, are felt most immediately in immigrant communities. You know, it's new unskilled immigrants, if they come through our legal system, or new illegal immigrants who are most likely to compete for and take jobs from people who did it the right way, who came here on a valid visa or came here and got a green card and then got citizenship. And you see more support in the first-generation immigrant community for enforcement than you do than you see reflected in the debate in Washington. Likewise, you know, the impact of immigrant crime. you know, MS-13 crime is much more likely to happen in an immigrant community than it is to happen in Chappaqua or Atherton.
You're better than many of your colleagues at forging relationships with this White House. You've developed a number of relationships. You seem to have an ability to get people on the phone and influence some of the thinking there about a range of things. What is the advice that you would give to your colleagues about figuring that out?
Donald Trump won and he's the president. And everybody needs to accept that, especially the Democrats. He has a wealth of different views advising him in the White House. And every president's entitled to have the views he wants. So they need to accept those realities. And they need to engage with the president and the vice president and his senior staff and his cabinet members if they want to be effective representatives and advocates for their states and for their districts.
Who besides the president and the vice president do you find yourself talking to?
I talk to almost every senior advisor in the West Wing on this or that or the other thing. Obviously, it varies by issue set.
Sure.
You know, if it's something in front of the banking committee on which I serve, I'm more likely to speak to Gary Cohn. If it's something about, you know, defense policy, I'm more likely to speak to H.R. McMaster.
Sure. Do you feel like there's that, a lot of people feel like there's a division within the West Wing that concerns them among Republicans between the moderates and people who were Democrats, Jared Kushner, Gary Cohn, and some of them, you know, the other axis is the Steve Bannon axis and the more traditional conservatives. Does that concern you at all that there is that division there? I mean, I would imagine that you talk to Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump about things that are going on, but that it's unlikely that a couple of years ago you would have thought that you would be.
There are divisions within the West Wing, and there always are divisions within the West Wing.
But not like this, right? Like this is
I think if you spoke to some who were around in the Reagan years, they would tell you about some pretty pitched differences in the West Wing. I would say that the media and Washington types love the Game of Thrones mm-hmm. stories.
It seems like Trump likes the
they
Game
love,
of Thrones.
They love power behind, look, power behind the throne stories have been, you know, appealing back to Shakespeare and beyond. But there's a reason for that. The person who sits in a throne is there by an accident of birth. Mm-hmm. And he may not have the abilities to govern. He may not have the interest in governing. So he may need a Richelieu. The person who sits in the West Wing is not there by an accident of the birth. He's there because he raised his hand and said, I can do this job better than any of you. And I'm the best person for this job out of 325 million Americans. And he got 60 or 70 million people to agree with him. That kind of person is not usually a wallflower, whether it's Donald Trump or Barack Obama or George W. Bush or any other of the 44 men who have been president. And that kind of person is not shy and retiring. There's just every president has trusted advisors, but the difference between sitting behind that desk and sitting in front of that desk is like the difference in sports, they say, between the longest 18 inches is the distance from the assistant coach's chair to the head coach's chair. It's the difference between advising and deciding.
Do you think we're going to get to a point where the Republicans are going to be able to start passing legislation through Congress? We are.
I think we passed dozens of bills already.
Well, major legislation, right? We saw what happened on Obamacare. This attempt to revive it seems like it's troubled too. We haven't seen action really on immigration reform. We saw, you know, the government's going to be funded through the fall, but on any of the big things, big ticket items, we haven't seen that. And what we've seen instead is reason to believe that what happened on healthcare could sort of that could happen again and again. That it'll be hard to figure out how to bring all the factions together to agree on something.
So first, I do want to dispute the premise of the question.
That's your right.
the resolutions we passed under the Congressional Review Act to repeal now, I think, a dozen different regulations are very important because they don't just repeal a particular regulation that the Obama administration ought not to have dropped at the last minute. They also prohibit any administration for the rest of time from ever regulating on that topic again without additional congressional approval. So those have a much longer lifespan than is commonly perceived. Second, this is one reason why I don't think the 100 days is a significant measure. It goes back to FDR when presidents were sworn in on March 4th and the Congress was not in session. And he called a special session that lasted 100 legislative days, not 100 calendar days. And we were in the middle of a crisis. And they, you know, the very first day they passed the Emergency Banking Act, which was passed in a matter of hours, in part because the Democrats had three-quarter majorities in both the House and the Senate. So I don't think anyone should be surprised that we haven't passed major sweeping legislation in these first 100 days of Donald Trump's tenure. And look at Obamacare. I mean, it took them 14 months. To pass it now that
they did
things in the end that they ought not to have done, like rewriting it in Harry Reid's office on Christmas Eve, or ramming it through the House after Scott Brown won the special election in Massachusetts. But it still took 14 months to accomplish that. It probably took 20 months to pass Dodd-Frank. They failed at passing immigration legislation in part because they had the wrong approach to it. So I don't think it should be surprising that we haven't passed sweeping landmark legislation. That just takes a while under the Clinton
administration. So what's the thing that changes it? Is it just over time?
Part of it is time. You know, Congress moves on its own schedule. Presidents always wish Congress would move faster. They always wish Congress would do more exactly what they think. That's just not the way our system of government is set up. And if you look at past administrations, it took George W. Bush a year to pass the No Child Left Behind Act. It took Bill Clinton until the August recess to pass his budget. You know, it took him until 1994 to pass a crime bill. So it's not uncommon that the major pieces of legislation that come to define the early days of a presidency don't get passed in the first 3 months of it. They get passed later in the year or in the following year.
I want to talk about, just to close out, a couple things that you have around the room on your desk. Lincoln books. You're talking about Lincoln. As it happens, there's an interview with the president that is just out, basically, as we're talking. You may have seen it. He was talking about Andrew Jackson. Then he said that he thought that Andrew Jackson might have, if he had been in place, might have been able to stop the Civil War from happening. And he said, people don't realize, the Civil War, why could that have not worked out? You're a person who reads a lot and thinks a lot about these things. When you have the president who doesn't read books and doesn't process things in that way, and doesn't have the depth of knowledge about some of these things historically, what is that? How does that strike you as someone who cares about these issues and cares about thinking through them in that way?
Henry Kissinger cautioned anyone going into the executive branch that they will be spending intellectual capital during their time there. They will not be accumulating anymore. That's a fair and probably correct point. I haven't served in high executive office before. I had enough time to read when I was a young lieutenant and off duty, but I can't comment on what it's like to be, the president or the vice president or secretary of state. You do have time to read in the Senate, and you should, because it helps you better serve the folks back home to have a better understanding of the world. A lot of people attribute the Civil War to the way Buchanan mishandled the crisis, and Andrew Jackson faced his own secession problems, and he was pretty firm towards John C. Calhoun in South Carolina. So I haven't seen the president's interview, and I'm not sure exactly everything that he said. And obviously, Andrew Jackson was a Southerner who held slaves. But, we reached a crisis in the late 1850s that might have been averted with different and better leadership. So maybe that's what he's alluding to.
Yeah, I guess the question beyond that, he's not someone who projects the sense that he spends a lot of time reading things. And he doesn't read books. You, as someone who values that, what that you think that the message that sends to children to, that was a concern that a lot of people had about him as a personality, whether not about politics, right? That this is people who want to have a sense of history.
Well, everybody has to unwind in one way or another. And you may look around my office and see, Lincoln or Tocqueville or Thucydides, but, there's a reason why I put those out on display. If you open my closed bookshelf there, you'll see lots of Daniel Silva and C.J. Box books
There's a quote from Thoreau when he published one of his first books that he wrote a letter to somebody. He said, my library is 1,000 volumes and 800 of them I wrote myself, because he couldn't sell the book.
But I think especially in a job as demanding as the presidency, again, a lot of people unwind in different ways. They clear their mind in different ways. When I was a younger man, I played golf. I don't play golf much anymore. I go for a run. That's one way that I unwind. Or I read not just, the collected works of Abraham Lincoln that you see sitting on my desk, but, Danny Silva's latest novel as well. So if the president unwinds by, catching some TV late at night or going to play golf, and I don't begrudge him that any more than I did, Barack Obama playing golf or George Bush going mountain biking.
Yeah. The other thing you have on your desk, just to close out, is this map of North Korea and South Korea. How worried are you about what could happen in North Korea, and how do you see that playing out? And this is a map, just a podcast.
Since you know this is a podcast, they can't see us.
It is a map that shows the light. It's from above. You can see the horizon of the Earth, right? And they've got the lights from China, the lights of South Korea, and just the dark spot of North Korea with Pyongyang identified in the middle of it.
And I would encourage any of your listeners to find this very famous photograph online. They can probably just Google Korean Peninsula satellite and see the picture you're talking about, in which Seoul is lit up like a Christmas tree, as is most of South Korea. And even China, north of North Korea, is lit up like a Christmas tree, even though there are some relatively rural areas on the side of the border with North Korea. And then in North Korea, you see one tiny little spot in Pyongyang. To me, that picture summarizes the difference between freedom and darkness, what the human spirit can achieve when it lives in freedom and has constitutional democracy and market-based economics, and it has security as well, versus what happens when it lives in totalitarian slavery.
Do you think we should be thinking about war with North Korea?
North Korea is thinking about war with the United States, so we have to think about it. Any kind of Second Korean War would be devastating, because just north of that dark line in Seoul, Pyongyang has thousands of artillery pieces and rockets dug into mountains. So putting aside their nuclear program, their conventional weapons hold millions of people in Seoul at risk, to include hundreds of thousands of Americans. However, as awful as a Second Korean War might be on that peninsula, I don't think most Americans are willing to live in a world where Kim Jong-un can hold at risk millions of Americans with an intercontinental missile that has a nuclear warhead on it. And they're obviously making progress in their missile technology. They've tested 5 or 6 nuclear weapons. Some estimates that have been published in Western media sources say they're acquiring multiple new warheads every single year. And ultimately, they're going to be able to combine those two technologies by marrying a working intercontinental missile with a miniaturized nuclear warhead that will be able to strike anywhere in the United States. And I don't think we can allow a regime as dangerous as Kim's regime in North Korea to obtain that technology.
And how worried are you?
I am worried in the long run. It's not something that has to happen tonight or tomorrow or next week or next month. But for 25 years, the United States-North Korea policy has been essentially to kick the can down the road. You could gussy it up in one way or another. Bill Clinton did, George Bush did, Barack Obama really did. But we've run out of road to kick the can down. That might have been a sound policy in the 1990s, you know, when you thought the regime might not survive the switch from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il. It might have been a sound policy in the 2000s when our efforts were understandably focused on the threat of Islamic terrorism. Sometimes kicking the can down the road is the best out of a lot of bad options. But ultimately, you usually run out of road, and that's where we are in North Korea. And I strongly support what the president is doing to try to confront North Korea. And I think Secretary Tillerson is doing a very sound job in his diplomacy with China and with our regional partners to try to bring greater pressure to bear on the Kim regime. As he said, we don't seek to change the regime in Pyongyang. We don't want to bring Kim to his knees. We want to bring Kim to his senses. And the path probably runs through Beijing. Ultimately, what we want is a denuclearized Korean peninsula in which Pyongyang doesn't threaten the United States homeland and the millions of allies and citizens that we have in the Pacific Rim.
That's such a bright note to end things on.
A lot of times when you look around the world, things aren't bright, but that's why you have a government that has to be willing to make tough calls to keep the country safe.
All right, Senator Tom Cotton, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.